And good morning to you. This is KCSB FM Santa Barbara, 91.9 on your dial, and www.kcsb.org. And it is about 8 minutes after nine. We've had gremlins afoot in the studio and out in the IT world, I think, more generally. But you are listening to No Alibis. I'm Elizabeth Robinson.
And I'm Maricela Marquez.
Also impacted by gremlins. We couldn't get our signal all the way onto the air to begin with. Thank you, Eric Fredericy, for handling all of that. And then they struck in Maricela's neighborhood, apparently. And you were without internet connection this morning, right?
Yeah, the neighborhood is out of cable, apparently.
Just ran right out of
Yeah, there's an outage in the Cox cable world.
So, all right. Yeah. Well, because of that, we're going to have a shorter than usual news moment, but let's tell people what we're doing first. And Maricela, you want to briefly tell us what's in the first hour, and I'll briefly tell us what's in the second.
We have the pleasure of an interview with Marisol Cortez, who is a community-based scholar and creative writer. She occupies a space between academic, activist, and artistic worlds. And she's been in environmental justice movements for 20 years, which informed her doctoral research at UC Davis. She'll be joining us this morning to talk about her debut novel, Loose at Midnight, in the first hour.
Yeah. Excellent. And a smiling face just joined us. So Maricela is listening in right now, and we'll be with you in about 20 minutes. In the second hour, we're having more of these folks who straddle the lines between the academic and the artistic world, as they should. The two things should be going together. So in the second hour, we'll be having Charmaine Chua and Shauna Redman on to talk about something that is very much in the news today, but that's not what we really intended. But we'll be talking about policing with them, the need for and the need not for, among other things, and about some countrywide, if not international, days that are coming up to look at constraining the degree to which we are policed and the ways in which it is done. So Charmaine Chua is in Global Studies here, and Shauna Redman is at UCLA. So that's coming, but we thought we'd sneak in a little bit of news before we go further. And Maricela, please go ahead.
Thank you, Elizabeth. So I wanted to share with our audience this morning a series of California bills that are currently making their way through the state houses, and the issue surrounds the passing of Angelo Quinto. And Angelo Quinto is related is the nephew of a good friend and colleague and associate student, Diana Collins Puente. Listeners, you'll recall that this past December, Angelo died at the hands of police, and there's a wrongful death claim that has been filed by his family against the city of Antioch. Just as a backstory, there was he was having a mental health incident, and his family called law enforcement to help, and he with was restrained and lost consciousness and then died 3 days later. And so that incident has of course, devastated the family and has prompted a whole community and a whole series of communities coming together to support the family in the Bay Area, as well as now legislative actions at the local and state level. So in terms of news, what I wanted to share were the following legislative notes. And thank you, Deanna Collins-Puente, for sharing these with me. So currently in 2021, there are the following California Assembly bills, AB 490, the Angelo Quinto Act of 2021. This bill would ban positional asphyxiation holds. That is, this is a bill to ban the use of quote-unquote positional asphyxiation holds that cause asphyxiation, including the knee-to-neck restraint, by law enforcement statewide. The bill is sponsored by Assembly members Gibson, G-I-P-S-O-N, and Bonta, B-O-N-T-A, and is currently moving through committees. The bill passed the Public Safety Committee and has moved to the Appropriations Committee. Assembly Bill 490 would amend Section 7286.5 of the Government Code relating to law enforcement agency policies, and would prohibit a law enforcement agency from authorizing techniques or transport methods that involve a substantial risk of positional asphyxia, including the need to neck restraint. For further details in terms of the narrative text of this assembly bill, folks can go to the government pages at legislature.ca.gov. It's again AB 490. The next is the Miles Hall Lifeline Act, and this is its title is to establish a mental health crisis response protocol and program. This bill is a bill to create a 988 number and immediate localized emergency response for individuals in mental health crisis by trained mental health professionals. The bill is currently moving through assembly committees, and the bill was passed the bill passed the health committee on 4/20, which was yesterday, and was referred to the Committee on Communications and Conveyance. The bill was introduced by assembly members Bauer, Khan, Berman, Chu, Quirk, Silva, and Ting, and co-sponsored by the Justice for Miles Hall, the Miles Hall Foundation, amongst others. That is an entirely other incident that was very, very painful. And that family is, of course, supporting this. The bill passed the health committee and was referred to, again, the Committee on Communications and Conveyance. For our listeners that want to support, up next is a bill to be introduced, which will be titled the Angelo Quinto Family Rights Bill of Rights. And this is a bill to establish the rights of families to have accurate, timely, and regular access to the family member, their medical information, and records related to an incident involving the use of force by a peace officer or custodial officer. And would affect and modify the use of force, release of records, and it would enact the Angelo Quinto, with the enactment of the Angelo Quinto Family Bill of Rights. It would provide expedited access to records, provide the family with a death certificate in a timely manner, and provide accurate updates to the family about the medical status of a person who is receiving life-saving care as a result of injuries sustained from the use of force by a police officer or custodial officer. The victim's family shall have direct access to and contact with medical staff who are treating the victim. One additional piece is a bill to separate the county coroner's office from the office of the sheriff. This bill was previously Bill 1303, and it essentially was vetoed by Governor Brown, though it had made it to his desk. The bill would amend in counties with a population of over 500,000 or greater, a separation between the coroner and the sheriff. And, it would allow the Office of the Medical Examiner to exercise the powers and perform the duties of the coroner without a public vote or election, or adopt a policy requiring referral of death investigations to a county that has implemented an Office of Medical Examiner for any case when there is a potential conflict of interest for the office of the coroner or the sheriff, sheriff-coroner's office. And finally, there's a legislative symposium where the Quinto family will be hosting an online legislative symposium on Friday, May 21st from 9:30 to noon online. And in future No Alibis shows, we will pass along the link for that upcoming legislative symposium. Finally, if people are interested, they could go to justiceforangeloquinto at gmail.com, and his name is spelled ANGELOQUINTO.
Thank you, Maricela. Unfortunately, the list of people or the list of incidents before which we could put justice for continues to grow. And I wanted to focus a little bit on that, even though we're going to focus more on that as the program wears on. But of course, yesterday, the jury came back with a guilty on all charges verdict against Chauvin, the cop who knelt on George Floyd's neck for an unconscionable amount of time. But every day almost since then, there have been incidents that come to the fore that are just like this. And sometimes we don't look at anything more than the use of force and the consequence thereof, or whatever rationale we're trying to give it. But I think it was yesterday or maybe the day before, I heard on Democracy Now an interview with a Chicago organizer. They were talking about policing, or what is called policing, talking about what had happened to the young man, the child in international terms. Adam Toledo would be considered a child at 13 years old, not a teenager, not anything else. So anyway, in talking about him, the conversation went very, very briefly to the fact that, you know, there are a lot of youth who are just sort of on the streets, have no place to go, or not in school, etc. And what they didn't mention that really disturbed me was what I wanted to do right now. And note that in 2013, then Mayor Rahm Emanuel, formerly part of the Obama administration, closed 49 schools in one fell swoop in Chicago. At the same time, there were many other buildings that were being vacated, declared derelict, or made derelict by boarding them up. But 49 schools, mostly on the south side of Chicago, were closed, which happened also to be the neighborhood where Adam Toledo lived. So just a little quick math, 7 from 13, which is 7 years ago that this happened. So he was a 6-year-old, and coming into schools that were seriously taxed by the efforts to absorb tens of thousands of children as their neighborhood schools were closed. Some of them were closed to merge with charter schools. Some of them were supposed to have merged with another existing school. The argument was that there were too people, although there's a lot of dispute about that. But what surely happened was that a lot of people lost access to their neighborhood schools. And it had been anticipated that there would be rises in truancy and other sorts of juvenile, lawlessness? I don't know. Which didn't necessarily happen, but what did happen was the success of kids in that whole cohort declined in by the measures I don't like, by testing particularly. But that was the measure that was used to say, this didn't really solve a problem, did it? So, you know, if we're understanding that Adam Toledo was hanging about on the streets, which I'm not sure that was an explanation, and it's certainly not an adequate one. But those are some of the economic underpinnings of the things that we're seeing happening right now. You can just Google or search for, forget those other people, search for Chicago school closures and come up immediately with a dozen references. Among them, that this was the largest number of school closures at one time in Chicago, and then later, it was the largest one in the country. And it wasn't the end. There were still more school closures. And if you see stuff, you can see all of these schools with plywood over the windows and so on. So there are many ways of dispossessing communities, and I think this is an important one, and I think it has to be connected to things like the death of the Adam Toledos of this world. And it was also a big move to charter schools, I should say that. And I think these are also some ways in which the Obama administration is implicated in all of this, if we hadn't figured that out already. We still have a couple more minutes. We'll shorten our music a little bit probably, but Maricela, you had, I know, a couple of other things, so why don't you go ahead or comment if you want. It's fine.
Well, just wanted to comment on what you were saying. I think that it's important to note that exactly as you just did, the context of the institutions and the context of supposed reforms are not disconnected. They have a great deal to do with one another. And most media will not make that connection. And understandably, they have a minute and a half to tell a story. Part of what community radio does, and I think is important, is to continuously connect the dots to other institutions like the educational system. Obviously, the use of government funds for both of the institutions you just critiqued, they're not distant from one another, and certainly we're very close in his life. And so it's important to do what you just did. I should say.
Thank you. It's important what we try to do in way too little time, often. Did you want to mention else, or shall we go to music?
No, and we should go to music. Yeah.
And then of course to Marisol Cortez. So do stay with us.
I do.
Yeah, yep. Go ahead.
Just as a transition, part of what we also do is that we try to balance out the very, very gripping, gut-wrenching, horrible things that are around us and try to do something about it. But we also wanted to honor Earth Day, which is we're in the midst of in the next day or so, depending on when and where somebody is standing. It is Earth Day. And with that, we sought out an interview that would make all those connections for us and bring us back
to
the light of day. So we'll take a music break and we'll come back with Marisol Cortez in a couple of minutes.
Yes. Thank you, Eric, if you would.
On the
Lovely Linda Ronstadt, who, what an extraordinary career she had. I won't say more than that right now, but you guys might want to. In case you're listening to KCSB FM Santa Barbara, 91.9 on your dial, and this is No Alibis. I'm Elizabeth Robinson.
And I'm Marisela Marquez. And with us this morning, we have a treat for our listeners and for ourselves, Marisol Cortez. I'll briefly state that I came to know of her first actually from an article. I remember reading the Praxis of Deceleration, and I didn't recall the author, but it happened to be Marisol Cortez. And then most recently, she has a novel out called Loose at Midnight, and all of the phones are going to decide to go off at the same time. And so with that, I wanted to introduce Marisol Cortez to our audience and welcome her to No Alibis. She is an independent scholar and co-editor of Deceleration News. And I'll invite her to share any other information that she would like to share with us about her bio. I do want to portend that I'd like to make sure that we do talk about Words for Birds, which is an event that will be coming up in the near future as well. So welcome, Marisol.
Thank you so much, Marisela, and also Elizabeth, for reaching out and thinking of me. It's great to be back in California, in a way. I think there's a lot of cross connections between what's going on there, what's going on here. You know, y'all were talking about Chicago. There's a lot of San Antonio, Chicago connections, you know, connections everywhere, right? So thank you so much for having me. I'm really honored to be on your program. Answer any questions you have.
Well, before we go there, because we have a lot to cover, but we have time. Wanted to start a little bit with what has come to be known, and I'm certain you're aware that that Santa Barbara is very well known in the environmental movement and environmental research and so on. And terms like environmental justice are somewhat new, though the work has always preceded the terminology. So I thought maybe you could share with us the beginnings of your work, because I happen to know a little bit about South Texas, having grown up in Laredo and Nuevo Laredo and went to school in San Antonio. Environmental justice work isn't quite the hallmark that South Texas is known for. In your work, it is quite central. So I thought you might share with us the beginnings of your work and its locality.
For sure, yeah. I think what you were saying about the work's kind of always been done, but maybe not necessarily thought of in those terms, like that really resonated for me. I kind of had to go to, like, it was when I went to California that I learned that term, but mm-hmm. I had already been doing that work and seeing that work happen in San Antonio. And I think it had been happening for a long time. People just didn't necessarily call it that. I would say that the very first political thing I ever did was be a poet. And as a teenager, even, you know, before I knew there were communities for political activism or communities for studying power relations in society, like, poetry was a way that I expressed my lived experience of those things. And then a little later, kind of when I moved back kind of to the neighborhood where I had grown up in San Antonio as a kid, I got very involved in an issue that was going on at the time. And I don't know when you were, Marisela, when you were in San Antonio for school, but like, so this would have been around 2000, 2001, 2002. So the issue was the PGA Village. Do you remember that? Were you there for that at that time?
I come back and fourth to San Antonio. So I'm aware of, was it the birds?
It was a golf resort that they wanted to build over the Edmonds.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. So just to give folks a little bit of sense of the political geography and the racial geography of San Antonio, the city grew to the north for very deliberate reasons, having to do with the disinvestment in communities of color on the west side, which is historically Chicano, Mexicano, on the east side, historically Black, the south side, also historically Mexicano, but kind of like later, like the west side's kind of like the deep roots of the Chicano community in San Antonio. And so political machines in the mid 20th century, basically, were able to direct to disinvest those communities and move all of that money to the north. And that's not a unique history to San Antonio, you know, like the histories of white flight and the histories of disinvestment, like that's every city, right? But what is unique, I think, and brings and makes those histories of uneven development inextricable from histories of environmental racism is that the north is also the direction of the aquifer, and specifically the recharge zone of the aquifer. So that's where all of the rain, any water that's entering the ground goes back down into our aquifer, which supplies water for the city and for the region, really. And it's beautiful, clean, pristine water held in these underground caverns. And so that's been the direction of development. And so as the city has developed to the north, the aquifer and water became a very intense political struggle that brought together kind of, I guess, like an environmental movement that didn't understand necessarily questions of justice, sort of like conservationist environmentalist folks, with a very longstanding movements around fair budgeting, right? Racially equitable budgeting. You know, where's the money being spent? And also, like Chicano and Black activists around the political process, because the budgeting stuff was related to the fact that people until the 1980s were very much like locked out of the political process. And so we had single member district voting, and there had to be a federal lawsuit to get that. And so going back to the PGA village, like there was a proposal so already when the PGA came in, there had been since the 1970s activism from all of, you know, that united, that had a kind of like multiracial, multi-class, composition over the aquifer against a mall that they wanted to build against, the Applewhite Reservoir, which was like an attempt to create an alternate source of water. So, to get around the sole source protection of the aquifer that was passed in the 1970s at the federal level to protect the aquifer. There had been a lot of, again, you know, Fiesta Texas, like all of these major developments that were proposed for the recharge zone of the aquifer. So that had already been going on for 30 years by the time PGA happened. And so PGA was really kind of what politicized me around around those issues and around environmental justice, though I didn't know that term at the time.
Sorry, Maricela, just to clarify, PGA is the Professional Golf Association?
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. Right, yes, Professional Golf Association.
I was thinking Pacific Gas and Electric from where we
did. Well, that too.
It's a very different entity. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, so they wanted to build a luxury golf resort on the far north side of the city, almost outside the city limits, with all of the, you know, development driver that would bring, you know, more houses, more businesses, just the fact of, you know, turning that land into lawn or, you know, golf courses at runoff. So, and then, you know, I saw that was my entree. I mean, I had done environmental activism before then, just kind of like, as a college student, but it was sort of very like recycling campaigns and, pollution, you know, it was not environmental justice necessarily. But then I think what opened my eyes was just seeing that you really couldn't separate out those issues of like environmental protection from the treatment of brown and black communities historically within the city of San Antonio. You couldn't separate it out from gender either. Like, I remember going to a court hearing, cause there were, you know, various suits filed against the developers of, that were building the, wanting to build the PGA, and seeing, the way that the all women, all brown women legal team was treated by the white judges that were hearing the case. It just like, I just felt like I saw with my own eyes the way that all of those issues came together. And, you know, like even at that time, like people really didn't call it, this is, you know, environmental justice movement work, right? I had to leave. Basically, I went to California after that. I had been accepted at UC Davis. I went on to grad school, did my PhD in cultural studies there. And that was when I understood, oh, like this work that I had been part of and that people had taken part of, like that's part of this bigger thing.
That's right.
There's like room for it, right?
Yeah. I really resonate with your story, and in fact, my master's thesis was on the IH-35 corridor and the tax incentives to bring Silicon Valley-ish computer industry to that space between San Antonio and Austin, and it happened to coincide right over the aquifer recharge zone. So I have a familiarity, although I'm a lot older than you. So that was like in 1987 when I was studying that. And at the time, there was no understanding even how to measure the water capacity of the aquifer. And since then, and I'm sure your work contributed to that much more, you know, substantially than my work, but it did raise that awareness in me. But going back to the linguistic connection, which is your strength, wanted to invite you to share with our audience a little bit about the term deceleration and how that ties to you, your work, the movement and change, and all this before we get to your most recent book. So sure. I think I understand a bit of the link, but perhaps you can share that with us next.
Yeah. So deceleration, I mean, it's the name of the site, of course, that, that my partner and I co-edit, that covers environmental justice kind of news and analysis, thinking and praxis for the South Texas region. But it's also kind of like it's an organizing value, or it's an inspiring idea that motivates the way we approach thinking about those issues and writing about those issues and organizing around those issues. And it comes out of, what Greg and I both experienced in different ways, him as a journalist and me as an organizer, just the way that movements can internalize like these productivist, almost like self-injuring logics of and disabling logics of like speed, intensity, like it's never enough, like you always have to be doing more. whatever you're doing is not good enough. And we were both very, like, even burned out wouldn't be the right word. Like, disabled, I think, would be the more appropriate word.
Mm-hmm.
Because we are both people. I identify as neurodivergent. I think he would use that word too, probably. We both have different health issues, maybe that make us more susceptible to that, you know, that way of doing things within activism, or for Greg, it was more kind of like as an environmental journalist who reported a lot on climate change, kind of like, I've heard it described as like, collapsology, like just this constant pileup. You're always constantly reporting a crisis, and you're not really, necessarily reporting on resilience or solutions or what people are doing to address issues, rather than just kind of doomsday like reporting. So deceleration for us became a way, coming out of like periods of significant disability, to think about what it might mean to do that work in a different way, in a way, like how do we reframe what we're doing? How do we talk differently about what we're doing? How do we treat our bodies differently? How do we treat each other differently within movements? And so deceleration is a slowing down, right?
Mm-hmm.
Against these logics of, which I think ultimately are capitalist, just this, yeah, like the way that we, as activists, it's hurry up, do more, it's urgent, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So trying to think, like, what would it mean to respond to climate change in ways that sort of more emulated, like, biological time?
Mm-hmm.
The temporality of our bodies, like, they get sick, they need time and space to slow down sometimes. Like, sometimes you're active and sometimes you're not. Getting back into the body in the way that we do our work and getting back into the rhythms and temporality of ecological time, instead of productivist capitalist time.
Yeah.
Thank you.
One of the things, as you're talking, that I, well, a sort of analogy is the notion of a slow food movement, in opposition to a fast food one. As you say that, and we're told we have X number of years before the planet is destroyed, it's hard to imagine how to climb down off of it. And I think, one of the ways we do that is, if we slow down to read rather than to do, et cetera, or to watch, if we go to slower places, walking, you just see the world differently if you're walking somewhere than if you're flying by in a car or even a bike, whatever, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, go ahead, please.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, for me, it's kind of like the difference between, we got to go to City Hall, we got to pack the court, you know, we got to versus like, what are the names of your neighbors? What are the names of the plants in your yard? Like, what do you actually know about the places that you live? Pay attention to those animals, pay attention to those plants, pay attention to the people around you. What are their needs? How can you come together with them to figure out how, I mean, that those are really the print. I mean, and again, like that work I think has been done for a long time and people call it resilience or transition or, I've been very inspired by, degrowth movement, which, is not super well known, I think, in the U.S. and definitely not in Texas. also movements within, like, indigenous-led movements in Latin America for Buen Vivir. So what does it mean, you know, instead of crisis and urgency as the organizing, as a thing that organizes our praxis in the world, our political action, what if wellness, community wellness, personal wellness, planetary wellness, what if that was the way we approach things? So it's not necessarily like you're always doing different things. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you have to go to city council. Sometimes, you know, you have to respond in that mode. But then how, what else are you doing instead that, you know, that might also look more like the pleasures of watching birds or the pleasures of knowing your neighbors, the, mm-hmm. The beautifulness of ordinary people kind of coming together to figure out how to help each other. Right.
Mm-hmm. I think that's the unifying theme around at least what I've read of your work. I've not actually read your novel entirely yet. Seen samples on your website, but wanted to share with our listeners that we're speaking with Marisol Cortez, an independent scholar and co-editor of Deceleration News, and our listeners can go to deceleration.news, I believe, to follow up on this stream of thought and inquiry. I did want to, as a transition, talk a little bit about part of what you're saying, and you mentioned uneven development earlier, and it does come to mind in relation to what you're speaking about, which is also the connection to, as you in your title of the article that I first read was Inner Work Public Act, right? Which is very different than most people think or talk or act. But it also is very, very much connected to that theory of uneven development and the purposefulness and the valuation, meaning monetary valuation of one type of act and the devaluation of another type of act because it's monetized or as it's monetized, right? So I think that entire line of inquiry is very deep and it has a lot of connection, obviously. In other words, people make money, and to make money, it's that, you know, the use of time differently, right? And so I think in your work, it would be interesting if you wanted to transition a little bit to your poetry, to your writing and to your, to the act of public actions that are, differently centered, I guess. Because A, it's all your work. And secondly, I don't think it's often thought of that, you know, and connected to justice movements at all.
Right. Yeah, no, for sure. I think, yeah, like what you were saying about the public part being the part that makes money. It's exactly in the activist world. It's like, yeah, the funding goes to organizations and then the organizations pay you to do XYZ. And then the organization, I mean, it's not any different than working at McDonald's, right? Like you want to get the most labor out of these bodies to fulfill the, whatever the funders want. And yeah, like there is a devaluation exactly of the inner work. And by that, I guess, yeah, like I would expand that to also mean like the work of reflection, mm-hmm. the quiet work, the work that's slow, the work that takes a long time, the work where you need focus and concentration to get it done versus I got to go here, I got to do this, I got to respond to this, you know, and that includes art, that includes poetry. I think I don't want to say lip service, but there's a lot of talk sometimes about within activist spaces about the importance of the arts, but then like, do you actually value the labor required to do that? And do you think of the work that comes out of that labor, a poem or a song or a book, as something on the level of you know, going in front of the powers that be and looking hard. So, in my experience, like in my embodied experience, like I can't separate out those things. Like they're all part of the same work.
I was just going to say that for most people, they're not. And so I think that's your unique voice, right? And so it is helpful. It's helpful to take us into that world a little bit, because obviously for you, it's balance, right? For most folks, it's a lot to focus on one thing, right? And so that winds up being this whole world of specialization and also valorized differently. So I'm wondering if you could share with us a little bit of that transition for you from reading science journals, for example. Yeah. I think Elizabeth wanted to interject.
Yeah,
I do, because it goes down the same path. But one of the joys of working at home is that we don't have the phone line into the studio, but my phone is taking a message, and I thought you would like it, and I'd like to share it with you. It's from Matt, who says he's listening, and he says, "It reminds me of Tony Cade Bambara," and then a short quote, "We'd better take time to fashion revolutionary selves, revolutionary lives, revolutionary relationships. Mouth don't win war. It don't even win the people. Neither does haste, urgency, and stretch out now insistence. Not all speed is movement. Ain't no such animal as an instant gorilla." And that's from On the Issue of Roles by Tony Cade Bambara. Thanks to Matt for that. But it seems to me, in part, very much where you and Maricela were going. And I do want to say that it is 9:57 and you're tuned to KCSB FM Santa Barbara. And we still have probably 10 minutes or so. And we do want to get to the book, Lose at Midnight, and even invite you to read a bit from it.
Sure.
After you deal with Maricela and Matt.
Yeah, no, I thank you, Matt, so much for that quote from Tony Cade Bambara. I love it. I was remembering too the title of an Kazuhaga has an article that we republished on Deceleration one time called "The Urgency of Slowing Down," and it's exactly the same kind of idea. So, mm-hmm. Thank you so much for sharing that. And I think Maricela, maybe you were asking about the transition. What also gets devalued or subjected, or in my life at least, to that logic of urgency was writing. There's always something that seems more important than writing a poem or writing a finishing book. And because the stakes are really high and a lot of really horrible stuff is happening, right? And I think a lot of times too, in movements, there can be unintended, a sort of message that you take up, like, well, it's selfish to focus on that. You know, other people have these needs that are very urgent, and that's where you put your energy and your time. But at a certain point, starting to go in academia and then realizing, oh no, I actually want to work in community settings. And then when I did work full time as a community organizer, I kind of had the same realization, like, oh wait, there's this other part of me that is actually primary, that that I've never given myself permission to, like, it was calling on me. And by that I mean the part of me that is a poet, or the part of me that is a writer first and was a writer first, was calling on me to give myself permission to to make that my political praxis. And part of that was, so I had been working on that book since 2010. And then at a certain point, I was like, am I going to finish this book? And if I am going to finish this book, like, I have to make a decision. At that time, you know, I had one child, and, you know, I had health issues and stuff, and I just had to make it. I knew that I had to make a decision. Well, am I going to go to meetings or am I going to finish this book? Like, and I made the decision I was going to finish the book. And then that led me to feel that it would be ridiculous of me to finish the book if I wasn't going to try to do something with it. Mm-hmm. Cause I'd always written, but creatively, you know, poetry and fiction and stuff like that. But, like I had stopped sharing that work or trying to do anything with it. I would write it and then I just, you know, put it away. And finally I was just like, it felt worse not to try to get it published than to, and get rejected than, the prospect of rejection was less painful than the prospect of not making it public, even if I had to self-publish it. So that was a kind of, that was a long, I mean, that transition took years. But it feels like it, yeah, like once I figured it out, I was like, oh, it's kind of like that, you know, movies, right, in like a dumb romantic comedy or something, like where somebody realizes they've always been in love with their best friend. Like, it kind of felt like that.
Yeah. That's a good transition to Loose at Midnight.
Yeah.
Which in and of itself as a title is intriguing, because for many years, most of the folks I went to grad school with that are Chicano scholars, Latinx scholars, have struggled for many years to have multilingual titles. And publishing houses don't like that, or they didn't like it. It's become more popular. So I thought maybe you could share a little bit of from the book, maybe as Elizabeth was suggesting, a reading from that, maybe your favorite section. I know authors don't find favorite sections sometimes, but you know it better than we do, so you can share that with us.
For sure, I'd love to. So I could read from, I picked out a few different sections that I enjoy reading, but maybe ask you, would you like me to read something that's more kind of like from the political part of the story, or something that's more from the love story part, or a little of, you know, something that's kind of both? I could do different sections.
Probably both.
Okay.
Yep.
So
since the theory is that the personal is political there.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to read a section from a chapter that's called Algo es Algo. Something is something.
Mm-hmm.
And it, you get a little bit of the political plot, the climate justice plot, and then you get a little bit at the end. It kind of foreshadows the love story part. The only bright spots that winter are the city council sessions where Lali sits in the plush auditorium seating of the council chambers with Chela and Naima, keeping an ear cocked for news of the city's legal entanglements with Sizemore. Sometimes checking email, sometimes listening quietly, sometimes snarking in whispers or taking notes. Something is revealing itself. Something is coming into view. Lali has not abandoned the student's habit of traveling everywhere with backpack slung over one shoulder, and in her bag is a spiral notebook where she collects notes and thoughts and even poems. Notas, she calls them. Feeling form emerge from non-form, the shape of an argument rising in relief against the chaos of observation, something that would explain the how and why of it, shining a light on what they need to do. These moments of clarity appear between long bouts of boredom, though sometimes they're moments of levity too. Once, Chela burst into the meeting late and unknowingly seated herself one row up from Butch Keller, of Keller and Keller, the most powerful developer lobbyist in town, and thus the legal representative of Sizemore Explorations, LLC. That man gets whatever he wants, Sister Soli had warned Chela long ago. I should know. I ran against his father for mayor. You see him involved, you know something's up. And now, there he was, behind unsuspecting Chela. Lolly had to rip a ribbon of paper from her spiral and dash a quick note, twisting over the back of her seat to pass it back to Chela. Psst, did you know Keller from Keller? Did you know Keller from Keller, Keller, and Keller, i.e. KKK, is sitting right behind you? Chela had glanced behind her surreptitiously, pretending to look out the window, then dipped her head to write back. I'll be sure to fart extra hard then. Yeah, it felt good to go to the meetings as gutter punk as possible. Braless and menstruating, dirty, stinky chucks with no socks and flapping soles, legs hairy and armpits funky as hell. Then there was the time the representative of a rare earth trade group, the United Rare Earth Association, lobbied the council in support of domestic rare earth production. Lolly and Chela and Naima had passed Lolly's notebook between them, furiously scribbling acronyms for a citizens' lobby that might oppose urea. The People's Organization of Ore Opposition, or POO. Citizens Against Corrupt Assholes, KECA. Demonstrating intense, agitated resistance without existing alternatives, diarrhea. And then there was the time they'd played hangman, on a day when they'd been sitting in the council chamber since 9 a.m, waiting for their agenda item to come up. Apparently, it had been pushed back since Mayor Mike was running late, in that morning on a red eye from a Spurs game in Mexico City the night before. Items had gotten pushed back, items had gotten jumbled around. So they waited, and as they waited, they played hangman, heads huddled together. F this shit, sorry, was Naima's secret phrase, which Chela easily saw before Stickman hung. Let's get high, was Chela's offering. Lolly stumped them. Poopity, whoopity, flushity, washity, plop, 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 Chela had whispered slowly as the puzzle finally revealed itself. What's with you and shit? She said, shaking her head. They'd played on, snickering and snorting like middle school malcriadas. And when the mayor arrived with face flushed, he flashed them ojo from his seat at the dais, making them shake even harder with silent laughter, eyes streaming. Today they have come to the meeting to hear the city attorney update the council on the status of investigations into what Sizemore knew about the cost discrepancy and when they knew it. And so they are caught off guard by the 20 or 30 people who file up the chamber aisle to excoriate the city for voting the previous week to sharply increase their electric rates. A rate hike last week? Naima gasps. Did y'all hear anything about a 15% rate hike they passed last week? Nah, says Chela. Mm-mm, says Lolly. Naima leans forward to fold her arms on the seat in front of her, chin resting on top, as the elder members of Vamos approach the podium one by one. Damn, she says, that's some serious shit in this weather. Shh, oye mama, I'm trying to hear what he's saying. Should I stop? Okay, I know you'll have I know you'll have a time schedule you have to stick to, but that's just a little bit.
It's very nice. Go ahead, Marisela.
I was just going to tell our audience for their knowledge, they're listening to my Marisol. We'll lose that mid winner of the Sergio Troncoso Award for best first book of fiction by the Texas Institute of Letters. Go ahead.
I'm just going to say quickly that Marisela's sound was breaking up through all of that. So the message was that we've been listening to Marisol Cortez, and she's talking about her new book, Luz at Midnight. And for those of you who are linguistically challenged, you might not get the title entirely. But I think it pretends some of what I think we find in the book, because I too have only read bits of it. And in some ways, it's structured, from what I have seen, like a poem almost as much as like a novel, with lots of short chapters. So with that, can I give you a final minute or so to have a closing comment? This has been great, by the way. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
I thought maybe you could share with us the Birds for Words notice.
Oh, yeah, I'd love to do that. Yeah, yeah. Okay, so on Saturday and Sunday of this weekend, Deceleration, along with a couple other groups, environmental writers and artists group called Stone in the Stream, Roca en el Rio, and then also the Mitchell Lake Audubon Center, we are going to be having an event called Words for Birds. We've done it the 13th year we've done it. And it's always for National Poetry Month. And, it's a celebration, and cry for protection of winged relatives. We have 25 readers. We had a lot of people sign up to read this mm-hmm. this year. It's all going to be online. So anyone from anywhere in the world can tune in and watch. And we have 25 readers. We're splitting it into two readings, one Saturday evening at 7 p.m. Central Time. And then the other one is Sunday on the 25th at 2 p.m. Central Time. And, yeah, it's a beautiful event. We'd love to have folks, anyone that likes birds or words, can check it out. It's on, if you go to Deceleration, you can read more about the event. Just go to deceleration.news and then search for Words for Birds 2021.
Thank you. And I did want to point our readers, our listeners to mcortez.net as well, which is a very good, landing site to capture all of this information as well as get to know Maricel Cortez. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much to you both.
And it's a tiny publisher, I think, a small publisher that has published this. Why don't you tell us the name of it, because I don't have it right in front of me.
Yeah, it's Flower Song Press, which is out of the Rio Grande Valley. Small but mighty press. And you can either go to flowersongpress.com if you're looking for the book, or if you just go to the website, my website that Maricela mentioned, that will also take you to, you know, directly to the page, Flower Song page, where you can order the book.
Yep. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a good one.
Yeah, yes. You too.
And happy Earth Day.
Yes. We're going to go to a music break, and it will be fairly brief because of our guests are now with us. And Maricel, of course, you're welcome to stay on if you'd like. Most people have other lives to go to. But Eric, can we have, you know, like maybe a minute or so of music so we can at least welcome our next guest? This is KCSB FM Santa Barbara, 91.9 on your dial. And www.kcsb.org. And welcome back to No Alibis. This is KCSB FM Santa Barbara, 91.9 on your dial, www.kcsb.org on the internet. And I'm Alyssa Robinson.
And I'm Maricela Marquez.
And Maricela has done the heavy lifting this morning so far, so I'm going to refer for a minute, but we will both be with you and talking about some very important and very timely things around policing, around alternatives to policing, about resistance to policing, with this morning who are Charmaine Chua, who is on the Faculty of Global Studies here at UCSB and has been very active, I think, with Cops Off Campus here. Also, for those of you who haven't been around, or nobody knows where anybody's been around, but I know it's more than a year ago now, there were strikes going on among the grad students, teaching assistants at all. And Charmaine, I think it's in addition to all of her academic and intellectual work, was a stalwart in terms of working to those students, other people whose unions either didn't exist or needed strengthening, or the inequities and all that need addressing. So thanks for joining, Charmaine. It's good to have you here. And I think, and also with us is somebody, I can't remember. I don't think I've ever had you on the air before, Shauna. Is that possible? Anyway, Shauna Redman, who is a faculty member at UCLA and who is in an interdisciplinary, or she is an interdisciplinary scholar of music, race, politics, and has a book that's recently come out, I think. Yeah. It has recently come out. I'm unclear of it about it, Shauna, because I received the notice of it long before it was available. But the book is Everything Man, The Form and Function of Paul Robeson, and another book as well, Anthem, Social Movements and the Sound of Solidarity in the African Diaspora. She also contributed a chapter to Futures of Black Radicalism and did a playlist that was apropos of the work that all of the people who were contributing that had done. Also, just quite by accident, when I opened my email this morning, I find that IAS, African American Intellectual History Society, is doing a piece with Sean, sort of the center of it, to talk about the importance of music and many of the struggles that we're engaged with. So thank you both for coming on. And I thought maybe we should start. There are events upcoming, as well as events that are being organized nationally beyond. And Charmaine, can you begin by talking with us about that?
Sure. Hi, Elizabeth, and it's really nice to be here. So Shauna and I are part of the Cops Off Campus Coalition, which is both a national formation that began around October last year and a UC-specific formation that began right after graduate students launched a wildcat strike to demand a cost of living adjustment. And as faculty, as grad students, we came together because, you know, the cost of living in California had become so untenable that grad students were demanding the basic right to be able to afford to pay and live and afford rent. And soon after that, we started to think about the relationship between the rising costs of universities and what we were seeing on the streets as, you know, a convergence of demands for the abolition of the police after George Floyd's killing. Yesterday's verdict makes really clear what we have been fighting for all along and long before this moment, which is that, you know, police departments will throw bad apples under the bus and they will sell particular cops as exceptional kind of problems to the violence of policing rather than indict the institution of policing itself. And our argument and our commitment on the Cops Off Campus Coalition has long been that abolition is actually about abolishing the conditions under which policing and prisons became the solution to problems, right? Rather than just abolishing particular cops for doing bad things or particular prisons or the buildings that we call prisons. So I think united by those visions, kind of driven by a desire to link the kind of struggles of labor and the struggles of abolitionists who have, you know, pointed out the kind of anti-blackness and white supremacy of the racist carceral state that we live in, we have now made a call for what we are calling Abolition May. And that is to join the nationwide, Turtle Island-wide, continent-wide call for the abolition and the defunding and the divestment of police departments across the city, across the U.S. and Canada and North America. But also, I think, to invest in alternatives, viable alternatives that will keep communities safe. We know that police, you know, as has been abundantly clear, do not keep our communities safe. And part of what we are really committed to is bringing that conversation onto our campuses, where the UCPD in particular has California-wide jurisdiction to police across the borders of the campus itself. And historically, this has meant that UC police have been about the protection of private, of the UC's private property in, you know, San Francisco, for example. UCSF, despite it being a really tiny campus, has one of the largest police budgets because it precisely is there to police the properties that UCSF is based on all around San Francisco. So, I can say more about kind of what we're planning for Abolition Day, unless you think that I should do it now, Elizabeth, but the kind of, you know, summary and the invitation is for those of you who are listening in the cities that you are in, but also on the campuses that you're on, to join us in a movement to think about the ways in which campus policing really makes these places that are dedicated to education and higher learning less safe and less safe and less you know, places where we can truly sort of build collective possibility with our students, as long as cops are on them.
Thank you. Let's wait on the events for just a minute, if that's okay. Or, because I think a couple of things that I'd like each of you, to address is the framework a little bit more. I think, first of all, most people think that police and prisons have always been a part of the world and a necessary part of the world. And there's a lot of, or maybe not, a bit of euphoria after yesterday's events with the conviction of Chauvin for the murder of George Floyd. But it has, it is, it seems to me, being framed as a break in the blue line, that is acknowledging the damage, the violence, et cetera. But also in so doing, it's like there's a bad link again. So maybe you want to talk about that a little bit. I would say that anybody that thinks policing prisons have always been here, which is part of policing as well, should read Michel Foucault's Punishment, and my mind has left me.
Discipline and Punish.
discipline and punish. No wonder it wouldn't fit. Thank you. I'd like, I guess, each of you to just address for the moment the degree to which people can or cannot even conceptualize what it is that you're trying to do. Because the first response usually is like, what are you going to do with the bad guys? Or what are you going to do when somebody breaks into your house or steals your car, etc.? So Charmaine, go ahead, and then Shauna, please come in. And Maricela, I see you brought your camera on because you might have something you want to ask too. No, not yet. Okay, so Charmaine, and then Shauna, please. And feel free to turn your cameras on while you're speaking, although nobody but the five of us or six of us can see that.
Thanks, Elizabeth. And I think you raised really important questions. So the first thing that I think is important to say is that abolition is not, is deeply concerned with safety. It is deeply concerned with safety, right? But the question is, what keeps our communities safe? And I think very often, particularly in places like Santa Barbara, which are so well-to-do, the immediate concern is about a protection of your private property rights, about concerns around things like theft, rather than to ask, right, what are the conditions that have produced a society so deeply divided by wealth inequalities in the first place? So my response to this would quite simply be that, you know, when we think about who keeps us safe, very, very particular communities will answer the police. And those are communities that have been, you know, identified with policing, who feel safe when the police roll by their streets. And the reality that we have to accept, and that history very clearly shows, is that in Black and Brown communities, that, you know, particularly in cities where the histories of racial segregation have produced lower income sectors of communities, and redlining and persistent policies of segregation have produced deep, you know, riven places of racialized violence, that the police have been a tool to enforce class interests. And that for most communities who are Black and Brown and of color and lower wage and working class, the police do not bring safety. And we, I think, don't need much more evidence than this, than the fact that as the verdict was announced yesterday, Makia Boyd was shot in Columbus, Ohio, at the same time that, you know, people were celebrating the bringing of Derek Chauvin to what they think is justice, for calling the cops because somebody was hijacking her car, right? So I think that the question of who keeps us safe is ultimately a question we want to ask. But rather than saying that the police are those who keep us safe, we really are invested in looking to our communities. Over time, police have, you know, increasingly, I think, replaced all of the functions of collective and different forms of care that in past societies people used to protect each other through mutual aid and through other forms of collective protection. And I think one of the questions that we have to ask is, you know, one of what it means to trust the police to do what ultimately we can do for each other. The last thing I want to say is that very often most folks will worry when abolitionists say, yeah, we literally believe that the world does not need cops or prisons, that most folks will worry and say we need some cops or some kind of enforcement that keeps us safe. And I want to point out here just quickly that there's an important distinction, I think, that abolitionists have made between crime and harm, right? Crime are acts or behaviors that have been criminalized by the state. They are historically and sociopolitically constructed to protect ruling class interests. So when we say, right? That, you know, cops need to solve crime. We need to also recognize that crime is not a fixed object. Certain behaviors are criminalized that are linked to racist state social control. But harm, I think, is a concept that comes out of Black feminist traditions. If you look, for example, at the Insight Women of Color Collective, where they want to think about the ways that harm is opposed to crime, right? It shifts our gaze to the kind of interpersonal, intercommunal, and structural behaviors that produce suffering and violence. So one thing I think that we need to think about is, you know, many acts cause harm but are not crimes. And many acts that are criminalized do not cause harm, right? So for example, building a giant pipeline that desecrates indigenous land and then ruptures and poisons the water supply for life on Earth is not considered a crime, even though it causes incalculable harm. And on the other hand, an unhoused person who's squatting or living in a building that they do not own because they have nowhere else to live because they've been driven out by high rents is considered criminal trespass, even though it causes little to no harm. So one thing I would encourage listeners to do is to think about these distinctions, right? And that we've been socially acculturated, I think, to worry about crime and to worry less about harm. And if we shifted our gaze, I think what we can start to ask is questions of what it means to build a just society focused on harm reduction, not crime.
Thank you very much. Shredman, please come in here and follow or lead in a different direction as you wish as well.
Yes, thank you. Charmaine has done a really beautiful job of laying so much of the terrain on which many of us are struggling and thinking and working towards a better world. So thank you, Charmaine, for that. Good morning to you, Elizabeth and Maricela, to the audience. I'm really pleased to be here talking about this work because it's very, very important to me, not only politically and intellectually, but personally, as I am a system-impacted person. My father was imprisoned for almost a decade, and so these issues have been on my mind and heart for many, many decades, for a number of decades. I'm only so old, but for a number of decades. Yeah. You know, I think the questions that are raised quite often very disingenuously in antagonism to abolition are easily, in some respects, responded to the extent that one of the base kind of considerations for people working towards abolition are really not how do we dispel of crime, as Charmaine mentioned, but think really comprehensively of safety, which means that there are other types of considerations that precede concern around crime, right? That we would argue for full employment, right? Well, before we would argue for more cops, full employment with union protections and living wages, that we would argue for universal health care that paid specific attention to mental health concerns, that we would argue for secure and affordable housing for everyone, that we would argue for free education for everyone. And it's my belief, it is borne out by evidence that when these things and any number of other things generated collectively by a community are put into place, that there is a significant reduction in harm and vulnerability to the violences of policing and the prison. So there are many, many visions that precede this call for an end to policing. These are struggles that have been woven and organized for intersectionally for many generations, right? Many of us using this language of abolition attach it to abolition democracy, which has been spoken of since at least the 19th century and was popularized in the scholarly realm by W.E.B. Du Bois, the eminent sociologist, as well as many others. And so we want to be clear about the fact that this is a stance that is not just anti-cop. The cops are a symptom of a broader structure of harm and vulnerability and premature death, right? As the We Charge Genocide document discovered and discussed in 1951, as Ruth Wilson Gilmore has argued for in her definition of racism, that all of these vulnerabilities to premature death are intersectionally lived by people who are meeting harm at every turn, not simply for their race, not simply for their economic status, but for all of these conditions in combination with each other. And I want to raise up again the name that Charmaine mentioned, Makia Bryant, right? Please. This young woman who lost her life thinking that the police were the answer, right? If we have alternative structures in place where we can call loved ones, family members, people who know our faces and know our names rather than the kind of cold stance of the police, we can call folks who know us in moments of vulnerability or concern rather than police, many, many lives will be saved. I am confident of that. So these types of concerns are ongoing, but it is important just to insist again that this is a world of our making, that abolition democracy is a world of our making, that we collectively generate the ideas and solutions together, and that mutual aid as one of the ways by which we begin to circumvent these structures of policing and vulnerability is one of the methods that has been championed very vigorously of recent, but again is a long-term project over many generations where we care for one another rather than relying on a failed and failing state to care for us in ways that they have shown incapable of doing. And so I want to just insist that anti-blackness is a structure. It's not a person. It's not Derek Chauvin. It's the structure that produces Derek Chauvins in every city and every town on this continent, in this world, right? This is a structure of dispossession and harm and vulnerability. And so the more that we can conceive of its alternative on a broad scale, the better positioned we are to actually imagine futures and live futures in which we're all safe and healthy.
Thank you very much. I'm going to give Maricela a chance to unmute, but say I always love it when we have connections between the two halves of the program. And one of the things that Marisol Cortez was talking about just a little bit ago was, do you know your neighbors? And I remember when Critical Resistance was trying to organize some things in Oakland for us to know whether there's a social worker or a nurse or a healthcare worker in your neighborhood. Would you know that so that you could call them rather than 911, which will send you directly to the police in most places or beyond? Maricela, please.
Just building off of all of this, I really want to thank all of our guests today and Elizabeth, and just wanted to loop in also the incident in Antioch, California, with Angelo Quinto, mm-hmm. and through that family's work and those community efforts up in the Bay, there are a series of legislative actions being proposed to the State Assembly in California, and one of the questions I have for you all is essentially, you know, as you began the interview discussing the work that you're doing in the local, meaning the University of California and or higher education, and that intersectionality between these institutions that both create a very confident Derek Chauvin and the situations where the most vulnerable are at that mercy. And so more centrally, I want to ask about next steps, I guess, within the UC. What can we do about it within our control?
Shauna, shall we go to you first, or does it work better the other way around?
Sure.
Charmaine says thumbs up to Shauna, so please.
Sure, I'll start just by speaking to some of the organizing that we've been doing at UCLA. I mean, I think part of the concern with abolition for folks too is just the scale of it, right? That they can't imagine it for virtue of it meaning that everything must change, right? And so we have to think about digestible ways and means by which people might become involved or see it working in practice. And so to think about it at the campus level, I think makes a lot of sense, as well as to think about it in our neighborhoods and in our communities. But at UCLA, we have developed the Divest Invest Faculty Collective, which is a group of faculty from across campus who are interested in moving towards the end of policing on our campus and in the UC system. We recognize that policing, just as it does in our communities, has brought uneven and disproportionately impactful harm to communities of color, to our Black and Brown students, around not just their kind of recognizable identities or presumed recognizable identities based on race, but also has brought vulnerability to our students around their status, their documentation around their ability to actually move through campus as if that is that their space, which it absolutely is. But it has also impacted folks who seek to visit campus or to take advantage of this being a public university, which is stated as a public good, right? And should not be enclosed and fortified in the way that it has become. Mm. So we are, working with students, with other workers on campus in order to strategize around how best to make this possible. And there are some specific situations that have happened at UCLA that have driven our campaign. One of them, one of the more significant of them in the last year, was in June of last year, the Jackie Robinson Baseball Stadium being used as a field jail for the LAPD, where they were detaining peaceful protesters who were rising up in response to police violence and in response to structures of anti-Blackness. And the university has never taken responsibility for having cooperated in use of their space as a field jail, nor have they taken responsibility for some number of those detained having also been their students. And so this is a responsibility that falls in their lap that they have decided to ignore. And so we've consistently drawn attention to that fact and organized around it, not only through our press releases and comments, but also through staging demonstrations there, most recently on Dia de los Muertos, where we had a performance art piece, as well as numerous community speakers and students who responded to their experiences of having been detained there. So that was one of the galvanizing moments. And we've produced a number of short films that have spoken to those students who have been impacted, spoken to workers and academics. And those can be found on the website for the Institute for Inequality and Democracy at Luskin School. And I can share that link with you for the webpage. But that, that site actually houses many of our communications. It houses the videos that we've produced and gives a lot of information about how we might have different conversations, not only in our workspaces, but in our communities. And so Divest Invest has been working really consistently to both combat this behemoth of policing on campus, but also to implicate the institution very solidly in its growth and advancement, right? That the university has been really central to not only developing policy that compromises many of our students, faculty, and staff, but also for creating the common sense that policing is the answer. Because they've not been invested in developing alternatives, because they've not been open to the challenges forwarded by experts on campus, they have actually been negligent in their responsibility to expand public thought, to challenge conventional wisdom. And so we're holding them to task for those things and continuing to organize and very much looking forward to Abolition May, which is going to be yet another announcement of the significant dissent that exists on campus around questions of security, of policing as a necessary element of our experience in that space. And we want to be clear about the fact that we are working in solidarity across the system, including the Cal States, and that these things are very close to us in a city that is disproportionately burdened by houselessness, disproportionately burdened by unemployment and underemployment, disproportionately impacted by the policing of Black and Brown communities who are vulnerable to disappearance at a moment's notice. And we are standing in solidarity with those peoples and with our own communities, right? Many of us are faculty of color. Many of us are students of color. We understand these concerns intimately and are working in concert with students who are especially at this moment concerned about getting cops out of mental health services. And so we want to lift up their campaign that they've been working vigilantly on for this last academic year in order to ensure that if you call similarly again to Makia Bryant for help, right, for help, that you are not met by force, that you are not met by more vulnerability. And so to get cops out of mental health services for students, staff, and faculty is a huge step towards development of the world that will actually allow us to be our most vulnerable selves, as we all are, facing mental health disturbances, facing other types of precarity, without feeling as though we're imperiled for having done so.
Thank you. Charmaine?
Yeah, that was a beautiful layout of what we're trying to do, I think, across the UC system. Thank you, Shauna. I want to take a moment just to say, you know, that when the University of California system, which I joined only 2 years ago and have sort of been rudely introduced to, its chartering documents suggested that it should be free of charge to state residents, right? But these were largely state residents imagined as white. And in 1966, when the Reagan gubernatorial campaign suggested increasing tuition, he explicitly said that those on UC campuses who would wish to agitate might want to think twice before they pay tuition, might want to think twice how much they want to pay in order to carry a picket sign. So as the years have gone on, the UC system has really been invested in the militarization, repression, and surveillance of its campus, even as that campus became more Black and more Brown, right? In the same, and this is, you know, from a statement of Black solidarity letter that Shauna helped to write and sign, but in the same 50-year period in which Black college enrollment increased by 476%. Tuition has increased astronomically by 340%, even as real wages have effectively stagnated, right? Elizabeth, was that a question you wanted to ask?
I just want to insert something to be clear for listeners who don't know this history. When Reagan proposed that, there was no such thing as UC tuition. So part of the outcome that he was pointing to was, you've been able to go to this free institution. Oh yeah, you have to buy your books and pay some little tiny fees. I know because I paid $60 a year.
Wow.
Or maybe a semester, I don't remember which. But what he was saying is that has got to stop. And here I'll invoke Damien Sojourner, who first brought to my attention one of Reagan's, satraps, who said something to the, wrote to Reagan saying, we are in danger of having an educated proletariat. And from that, the notion of tuition began to raise its ugly head. So sorry, but I think that's an important understanding, that when we're talking now about going back to free institutions, it's not from space somewhere that these ideas originate.
Absolutely. I'm so glad you added that context, Elizabeth, thank you. Mm-hmm. The thing I was going to mention is that we're seeing the continuity of those assumptions right now. Most recently, the UC system has proposed 4 reforms to the UCPD, to UCPD policy, and I'll say them quickly, but one is to enforce the distribution and use of body cameras, many of which policies contain discretionary rights for police officers to block the release of body cam footage. We also know that body cams increase images of Black deaths, but they do not stop them. The second is to award senior retired police officers with concealed carry weapons. The third is to, you know, ban carotid holds, which has already been done on a state level, but to continue allowing the use of deadly force in other forms, just, you know, as long as one justifies it, right? So kinder, gentler use of force. And fourth, and perhaps most horrifyingly, the UC has now proposed to create what they have called a system-wide response team that is akin to something like a SWAT team, mm-hmm. or a UC version of the National Guard that would be mobilized during emergency response, by which they really mean mobilized during student protest. And this, they say, comes out of a report that was commissioned in the 2009 to 2011 period, just as the UC system was deeply engaged in Occupy student protests and as tuition prices really were starting to rise. So we really have to ask this question, right? Why this demand of an injection of millions of dollars into the UC system towards the militarization and surveillance of an increase of policing at the very same time that our communities are asking for defunding and divesting and the reinvestment of those funds into our students? So, one of the things that I think we are fighting against as a Cops Off Campus coalition is that under no circumstances should these policies pass. But beyond policies, because we are always put and placed to fight on the terrain of making piecemeal reforms. So beyond policy, I think what we need to keep our eyes focused on is the ways in which the UC system has continued this pattern over a long history, and that fighting these singular reforms are not going to stop the general trend towards the militarization of the police. So at the UCSB level, you know, we're mobilizing across the university to demand not just that these policies do not pass, but one of my colleagues, Terrence Wooten, I love how he says this, but he says, we do not need permission to do abolitionist work, right? We do not need position from the chancellor or permission from the UC president in order to enact the kinds of mutual aid and collective envisioning that keep us safe. At UCSB, that's meant that every Friday we've gathered in Isla Vista to do what we call Coffee Not Cops, where we have given out vegan cookies and coffee as we've invited people to talk about abolition and invite people into our coalition. One of the things that we've done amidst this is to hand out pamphlets that give people alternative numbers to call besides the police, of which there are many existing resources in the Santa Barbara area. And then in the Santa Barbara specific context, I also want to mention that this Sunday at 1 p.m. at the Santa Barbara Courthouse, El Centro and UCSB Cops Off Campus and Healing Justice Santa Barbara is gathering to do a merch and a visual to remember the lives of Dante Wright, Adam Tullio, Makia Bryant, Angelo Quinto, Chris Ruiz, and many more who've lost their lives in Santa Barbara County and elsewhere. And then, so finally, let me just say that at the Cops Off Campus level, we have a massive coalition now of 30 and close to now 40 campuses committed to what we are calling Abolition May. Abolition May begins May 3rd with what we are calling for as a mass work stoppage. In other words, asking faculty and students to cancel classes, whether synchronous or asynchronous or online or not, refuse to attend university events, allowing TAs to cancel sections and supporting students' refusal to attend class. We We are also culminating Abolition May on May 25th, which is the death anniversary of George Floyd, by joining our communities in the streets. But in between, what all of these campuses are doing is we have scheduled a public calendar where each campus is taking up a day to build a direct action on their own campus. And at UCSB, our day is May 17th. Details are forthcoming, but we are planning a march and a vigil in the Isla Vista area. And we do this all, I think, as a kind of mass demonstration of the force of communities that are, you know, committed to abolishing the police, and to starting, with, you know, where they are, which is for us on campus is where we work and live.
Thank you. Marisela, please.
Oh, thank you very much. I just wanted to voice the question that Marisol posted in our chat box. And she writes, thank you. I believe Charmaine and Shauna mentioned that their coalition is nationwide, wondering how campuses beyond the UC system might join up with the effort. One of the victims of police violence in San Antonio was a student killed by campus police.
And let me say, we've got like a minute and a half, and if each of you could briefly, for a closing comment, we'll come back to this in future No Alibis as these events are unfolding. Shauna? Okay, Charmaine, go ahead.
I'll finish quickly and just say, Marisol, thank you for that. And if anybody's listening beyond the UC system, we invite you to join us. Our website is copsoffcampuscoalition.com, and you can find lots of information there. I'm also happy for people to Google me and email me, and we can stay in contact that way. But I'm, committed to linking up with as many campuses as possible before Abolition May.
Thank you.
And yes, I'll just say that another clearinghouse for this effort has also been Scholars for Social Justice, which Barbara Ransby, Kathy Cohen, and many others are deeply involved in. And so there is a coalition of campuses across the country, many of them student-led, Black student organizations, Latinx student organizations, who are actually putting the question to their institutions every single day, that are happening from Yale University to UCSD. So this is a Turtle Island-wide effort, and all of those organizations in some form will be present during Abolition May, so please check out that calendar. And resist reformist efforts, please, everyone. Let's be mindful of keeping abolition in our sights and only conceding that ground that will get us closer to shrinking the police state.
You too, you You four have been wonderful this morning. Thank you very much. We have too little time. And for Sean, I intended to play a little bit of Paul Robeson as a salute to her work and to her son, who didn't come in as far as I could tell during this. But I have to say, it is 10:59. You are to KFM Santa Barbara, 9 on your dial. Please stay tuned. Next week, we're going to come right back again. Thank you for your time. Eric, take us away.
KCSB News is keeping you informed about the coronavirus pandemic and related events and resources here in our community. Here with a mini news update, I'm Ashley Rush with KCSB News. Today is Wednesday, April 21st, 2021. Santa Barbara County has moved into the less restrictive orange tier. According to the new health officer order, more indoor activities are allowed in accordance with the blueprint for a safer economy. Under the orange tier, restaurants, movie theaters, museums, zoos, aquariums, and places of worship can open indoors at 50% capacity. Gyms, wineries, and breweries can open at 25% capacity, while bars with no food service can open outdoors with modifications. Retail stores have no capacity limits. The county has moved into the less restrictive tier because the case rate is now at 4.5.